This is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction Show. Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here along with Yuona June Thiessen and Mark Thiessen. It's the Thiessen Clan talking about the Law of Attraction here on Thursday. It's June the 4th. We're in June already. 2015. Yes. Amazing. This year is halfway over. I'm still getting used to writing 2015 on checks.
I know.
but we're continuing our theme that we started last week of talking about scientific studies that have been done in relation to positive psychology and in relation to just simple neurobiology.
Yes.
But simple in the sense that these studies are providing very simple solutions that people can use in everyday lives to do very remarkable things. And that description, I would say, describes very well the particular study you found for us this week, Yuona. Why don't you fill everybody in on what it is we're going to be talking about?
We're going to be talking about the effect of meditation, comparing the brain imaging, the pictures of those who meditated for a long term, you know, versus those who, the non-meditators, as they're referred to. But what a lot of these studies and studies like this are doing are showing that, you know, the modalities that are involved in the law of attraction and what is called New Age practices that was, you know, previously referred to as kind of woo-woo, you know, now hardcore science is actually validating a lot of the things that the gurus have been saying for, you know, decades, maybe even centuries. But, you know, because this research, it comes out of the University of Pennsylvania.
Now, hang on here. I've just gotten used to calling this stuff woo-woo. You're going to take that term away from me now?
Yes, indeed. It's going away.
All right, so take it away.
Yeah, because the guy who is in charge of this study, Dr. Newberg, he's a recognized, nationally recognized neuroscientist, you know. He is a leader in his field in terms of neuroimaging and the studies involving pictures of the brain and different regions of the brain. And so he has collaborated with other scientists, one of which is Dr. Amen, however you say his name. And they've both written extensively about some of the, you know, basically the relationship between the body and the mind and neuroscience and how all of that can come together to give us a better understanding of why we do what we do and how we can change some of the things that we want to change. And so, you know, they are looking at specifically, he does a type of neuroimaging called SPECT imaging, and SPECT imaging, it's SPECT, which stands for single photon emission computed tomography.
Say that one five times fast.
I know, right? And so, you know, picture the weather news and those images that the weather, the meteorologists show you. Those are the kinds of images that he gets on for the brain. And so instead of it, the different colors representing different pressure systems as they do in the weather, it represents different areas where the blood flow is different. So an area with increased blood flow will be red or yellowish compared to a blue-green, which has a relatively lower blood flow.
Okay, so sort of a color mapping similar to what you would get if you did a I can't think what the kind of scan is called, but the magnetic scan, whatever that's called.
MRI?
MRI, yes, that's the
okay.
One.
Yes. Because actually some neuroscientists use MRIs. They use the functional MRI, which shows different areas of the brain that are active, or they use structural MRIs, which show the size and different shapes of different the different patients to help them make diagnosis and follow treatment of different neurological diseases. So they're all different types of imaging that you can use, but he uses the SPECT imaging. The fMRI is actually more popular, believe it or not.
Okay.
But those look for more function, in, as the name implies, in terms of the different regions of the brain, whereas he's looking for specifically blood flow.
And again, similar to our discussion last week, blood flow is the focus of these studies because of the advantages that occur to the body when more blood passes through to feed oxygen and feed nutrients to all the different cells that need to have oxygen and nutrients.
Yes, indeed, right. And so in these studies where they're looking at the brains of those who meditated for a long time compared to those who have not who are not meditators, they do two types of study. They do the real-time studies where they look at what's happening to the brain of someone who's meditating compared to someone who's not. And this particular study is looking at the long-term effect. So here the subjects are people who've been meditating for 15 years or more, and they're comparing it to people who don't meditate.
Okay, that seems like a pretty broad delineation. So what did they find out?
Well, they're looking to see, you know, on baseline, on, you know, when you're not meditating, you're just going about your regular day, how do the different areas of the brain, what brain areas are more active than others, right? And so, you know, given their knowledge of what areas of the brain are involved in different activities, they can have an idea of what's going on, you know. Dr. Newberg, he plans to do more studies where they're looking at the brain, they also try to look at the body and see if there's a correlation. But so far, they've only been, you know, doing it separately. Mm-hmm. But they had five basic hypotheses that they started off with. And in terms of the brain, they were looking at in five specific areas or regions of interest, as they call them. You know, scientists always have to have acronyms, the ROIs, as they say. So they're looking at specifically the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe, the frontal lobe, two, the parietal lobe, three, the midbrain, four, the limbic region, or the region involved in emotion, and the thalamic region, which is involved in sensory processing. And so what they're looking at is the cortex, and the cortex is the region just below your skull. So that's where, you know, that's the cortical region of the brain, and that's where a lot of the processing of information is concerned. But each area is responsible for different things. And so when it comes to the frontal lobe, now the frontal lobe makes up the largest part of the cortex. And there are some things you need to know about the frontal lobe. Firstly, the frontal lobe is not fully, your frontal lobe is not fully developed until at around 25 years of age. So children have very minimal frontal lobes, even, you know, teenagers and adults, young adults, their frontal lobes are not yet fully developed. And that's one of the reasons why in our country there's a rule that says you cannot put to death, you cannot execute someone for a crime who's less than 25 because of that reason, actually. Because they don't have a fully developed frontal lobe. So the frontal lobe is responsible for helping you to make decisions and to be disciplined, to know right from wrong. So it's the executive region of the brain. Incidentally, it's also severely damaged, they've seen, in people who, mentally disturbed criminals and those, you know, people who just have issues relating to the world and how they behave and how they act. And so the frontal lobe is very important in helping you make decisions, set goals, and stick to it. So they wanted to see how the frontal lobe of someone who meditates long-term compares to those who don't. And, you know, their hypothesis was that there would be an increased blood flow, and surely there was an increased blood flow to the frontal lobe, and specifically to an area called the prefrontal cortex. That's just behind your forehead and on the left. And interestingly, that is the area that's associated very intimately with your amygdala. And that's another region that they looked at. But, you know, the amygdala is the brain structure that is responsible for evaluating and decoding your emotions. So if you have a strong functioning prefrontal cortex, then it is able to control, manipulate, you know, to basically set limits on your amygdala and not let your amygdala run the show.
So basically we're talking about emotion versus reason here.
Yes, exactly. And so people who meditate have, you know, they have more activity going on in the front of the prefrontal lobe versus those who don't meditate.
So do we infer from that they're able to engage in reason activities more easily?
Yes, and right, that is what happens. And on the converse, they are less likely to be controlled by their emotions.
Okay. So the first takeaway, I guess, from looking at this whole concept of meditation and how it affects the brain is that people who meditate are less likely to be dominated by their emotions and more likely to be able to control their own reason.
Yes. And, you know, last week we talked about the effect of exercise on depression. And other studies have shown that people who suffer from depression have usually have functional issues with their amygdala. And, I was reading something very interesting. This one of the researchers was saying that in the study that they did, what they saw was that people who were depressed, when they showed them pictures, sad pictures, negative pictures, their amygdala just lit up. And when they showed them happy pictures, you know, happy faces, smiling faces, you know, gifts or beautiful scenery, there was no response in the amygdala.
So the amygdala is actually dealing with negative emotion.
Well, in depressed people.
In depressed people. Ah, okay. What happens with somebody who's a happy person?
Right. So the amygdala then should be engaged in both types of emotions. It's basically involved in decoding and evaluating the emotion and evaluating whether this is good, it's rewarding, is it something I should take care of or should I be aware of? Do I need to do something about it? Should I hold on to this emotion? That's the job of the amygdala. But in people with suffering from depression, it's basically stuck in the sad negative response mode.
So essentially what we're describing here is what happened to me and what happens to others who are stuck in a depressed or a non-happy state and are struggling to get out of it. They're basically not getting the signals in the amygdala that one would normally associate with a healthy emotional response.
Exactly. Yes. So somehow the amygdala got, you know, overstimulated with negative emotional experiences, and it got stuck in that mode for some reason. And then the prefrontal cortex, which is supposed to be the boss of the amygdala, somehow the connection is not happening to tell the amygdala, okay, I got your message, but everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that meditation helps with.
Interesting. Once again, communication becomes a serious issue.
Yes. That's the key. The brain, you know, the brain is an entire processing mechanism, and all parts of it, they have their different function, and it's important that all parts communicate. There must be an integration of that the information so that it can be respond to appropriately. When there's breakdown in that communication, but for whatever reason, that's when you have these types of emotional diseases like, depression or anxiety or other types of issues.
Okay, so where did our trusty researchers go with these initial discoveries?
Oh, so, you know, that's interestingly, the guy who's in charge of the research was somebody I was telling you about some time ago on another show, Dr. Newberg, because he has written a book called How God Changes the Brain.
Really?
Yes, in fact, yes. And in that book, where he talks about meditation and how people who practice meditation and how it affects, you know, the differences in their brain. And he's, you know, the study includes Buddhists and Christians, you know, all types, whether, you know, Pentecostal, Catholic, whatever, and even, you know, New Age people, anybody who practices any type of meditation, he uses them in the study and compares them with other people. But in the book, the last part, the book is divided into three parts. And the last part of the book, he, you know, the first part is a lot of brain neurobiology kind of thing to kind of get you to understand what you're reading.
Or to put you to sleep if you're trying to use it as a sedative at night.
Right. Well, for me, it was like, oh my goodness, I just died and went to heaven. But
being a neuroscience PhD, I would think that that would actually be true. That,
yes.
You know, for some of us who are not quite interested in that, I think the sedative approach is actually quite useful.
Well, maybe you can skip the first and the second part. The second part talks all about his research. And the third part is where he actually then tells you how you can accomplish these same effects without actually being religious. So he gives you...
Let's define something here. He's using the word religious as being equivalent to meditative?
No. No, he's using the word religious to... imply someone who believes in a higher being and are involved in some kind of religious practice in their life, right? And then that includes meditation.
Okay, so meditation is included in the broader category, but he discusses the other aspects, which I presume involves practices of various religious faiths and beliefs.
Right, yes.
Okay.
But then he goes on to tell you how you can achieve some of these benefits, you know, in terms of your brain and your psyche, basically, by, you know, outlining a particular practice. Because one of the studies that he did, he had a group of people who had never meditated before, and he put them on a 12-week course of meditation. And he took pictures of their brain before they started, during the meditation, and after the 12 weeks of meditating, practicing meditation every day. And he was able to show the benefits that these people experienced over, you know, within a 12-week period.
And how did those benefits compare to the religious people and the steady meditators who he used, I guess, as his baseline?
Right. So he saw changes very similar to what they what these people experience. You know, he saw the increase in blood flow to the frontal lobe, you know, involved in cognition and this decision making, involved in the thalamus, which is one of the hypotheses that he had in this study, which is sensory processing. So it helps you better to process all the information and the stimuli that's coming into your brain and to your body. Other areas included the parietal lobe as well as the amygdala. So he did see those positive changes. Now, what he would like to do, hopefully, is to see how long those changes persist. You know, how long does it take to get the permanent changes that he saw in those who've been practicing for 15 or more years.
So that's something that is yet to come.
Yes. Okay. Yes, he's following those people.
Okay. So I guess there are a couple of things that are useful here. First of all, for those who are not particularly religious and not churchgoers anymore, never fear, they actually have a way that they can achieve nirvana by not going to church. They can do it through meditation.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that's one of the things he talked about, the different types of meditation, but yes.
And then the second thing that I can draw from this is that I'm really at the limit of my ability to handle all these different concepts simply because I don't know most of the terms very well. So let's see if we can try to bring it down to earth a bit for somebody who is a non-practitioner of neurobiology.
Right, right.
How does the average person understand the scientific information you presented?
The basis of the information is that what they saw was that there were changes in three main areas of the brain. The area involved in modulating your emotion, the area involved in cognitive processing, thinking, and making decisions, and also in the area of your sense of self, your perception of your body, your personal space, your evaluation of the space around you. Because what meditators are able to do is, you know, some meditators are, you know, as you know, have those out-of-body experiences, and there are areas of your brain that's associated with that. And that's involved, that plays along, you know, we read the book by the neuroscientist who had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked about when she had a stroke and a certain area of her brain was no longer functioning.
Jill
Bolte Taylor, my stroke of insight. She felt a oneness and a connection with everything and everyone around her.
Okay.
And so there's a particular area of your brain that gives you a sense of self, gives you a specific sense of who you are. You're different from everybody else and everything else around you. But meditators are able to reduce that and feel more of a connection with the things and the people around them.
Now, we should probably define meditating too, but when I meditate, essentially I'm sitting quietly or lying quietly and trying to just focus on one thing and not allow my brain to go running wild on, you know, what the work of the day is or something like that. That, for me, is meditating. Okay. The idea of an out-of-body experience, that happens, well, never.
Yes, and so there's, you know, meditation is an umbrella under which there are various forms and types and effects. You know, you can go from, you know, relaxation all the way to the outer body experience and everything in between. But in terms of neuroscience, you know, we know now that what meditators do, and we've talked about this a little, is that they actually change the frequency of the vibration in their brain.
The vibration in the brain.
Yes.
Now that's starting to sound almost metaphysical, because of course metaphysics talks about vibrations as well. So let's reiterate again. What's this vibration in the brain that you're talking about?
Well, it's a tangible vibration. It's the vibration at which the neurons are vibrating, and they can measure that. They can record that, and they can show that on an EEG, an electroencephalogram.
Okay, which most people, I think, have heard of.
Right.
Vibrations.
So there are different frequencies. I don't know the exact measurements, but you have beta, which is when you are aware and alert, and then as you get more relaxed, you go into alpha state, and that's when you're calm and you're just kind of relaxing. You know, you can get deeper than that, and there's delta. That's when just before you fall.
I think that is when you're asleep, is delta.
So it's beta, alpha.
Beta.
Theta, right. And theta is the one where you're just before you sleep. And delta is when you're actually in sleeping mode. And most people, you know, don't go there until they're in deep sleep. But there are meditators who can go there at will and not be asleep. So
the vibration we're talking about is waveform.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Now we're talking a few hertz. We're not talking, you know, kilohertz or megahertz or anything like that.
Yes, it's very few. It's like, oh my goodness, I wish I had the measurements.
We're not talking about painful hertz. We're talking about H-E-R-T-Z.
Right. Yeah, so like 5 hertz, 10 hertz, 20 hertz, 30 hertz. That's kind of the range we're talking about.
So it's a very slow kind of wavelength that we're talking about.
Yeah, cycles per second. That's what a hertz is.
Right.
1 hertz is 1 cycle per second.
As opposed to music, which runs in the hundreds or even thousands of cycles per second.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they can measure those, and they can tell which state your brain is in. And so meditating actually is a form of actively changing those frequencies at which your brain, your neurons specifically, are vibrating.
Okay. So everybody who meditates to some degree or other is experiencing vibration. So let's tie that in again to what you were talking about before, now that we've defined our terms a little bit better.
Right. And so under these different states, when you're in those different states, the brain behaves differently. there are different neurotransmitters, neurochemicals that are released, which have a different effect on your body. So you know, it feels different. Your cells respond differently. The reactions in your body are different under those different states. Different things happen when your body goes into those states.
Okay. And yes. I presume there are various health benefits involved in the various states that come from the long-term meditation. Otherwise, we wouldn't be bringing this up. So talk about that.
Yes. So, of course, when you, you know, are in the lower, more relaxed state, it means that your body is not producing all of the stress chemicals. And, you know, we know that those stress chemicals, when they persist for an extended period of time and they become chronic, they actually start to cause, malfunction of the cell first, then destruction of the cells, and eventually death to certain parts of the brain and also body.
Mm-hmm. And meditation. Yeah, definitely something that we want to avoid.
Right, exactly. But in terms of the health, the benefits, you know, the benefits, besides being physical, there's also the emotional benefits. So, you know, as we talked about, you learn to modulate your emotions so that they're no longer in control of you. So, you know, when you are facing a stressful or a perceived threatening experience, then you're able to respond much differently. You know, instead of responding simply from the low brain state, or as I talked with you about sometime before, instead of responding like a reptile, you're able to respond more like a higher form of animal, which is what has the frontal lobe, because the lower animal form, they don't have frontal lobes, or they have very little. One of the things that distinguish the humans from the animals is the humongous frontal lobe that we have. And so being able to actually engage the frontal lobe and allow the frontal lobe to modulate what's happening on an emotional level, that is one of the benefits of meditation. So it helps you to stay calm and relaxed, even in a stressful situation. And it just gives you an overall improved sense of self and an improved sense of well-being. And we neuroscience and psychology had already, you know, recorded that. But this is now they're able to actually see what's happening on the level of the brain structure, because of the brain imaging techniques that have come into science in the last 10 years or so.
Okay, well, to quote Monty Python, my brain hurts, so it's time to take a break and meditate for a little bit. Okay. Let's take that break and then come back afterward and see if my brain can absorb some more about all these wonderful pieces of information that will tell me ultimately what I think I've known all along, which is that feeling good is good and feeling bad is bad.
Right.
You're listening to LOA Today here on PRN. We'll be back after these messages.
Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof.
Welcome back to LOA Today. Walt, Fiona, and Mark on this Thursday, June 4, 2015, talking about the brain. And we've just been through a little bit of meditation, trying to settle ourselves down after that first intensive half of the show. It occurred to us, though, while we were meditating, that it would probably be a good idea to tie all this into the law of attraction, since that's what this show is all about. So, Yoona, why don't you tie all this into the law of attraction?
Right. So, law of attraction, or LOA, is all about deliberate creation. And we have a hard time creating deliberately, even when we learn about the possibility of doing so. Well, I think we still do deliberately create, except we created the direction that we now don't want to. And in order to, you know, change that, in order to now create the good things, the happy things that we want in our lives, we have to remove most of the programming that's, you know, recorded in our brain. And meditation is actually one of those very effective ways of doing that, because here we're seeing with this study that meditation brings about changes in the brain on a structural level. So what that means is it's actually changing the patterns and the neuronal, the networks that are in our brain. The scientists are showing that that's what's happening on a physical level. When with people who meditate, they change their brain. And so for those of us who are practicing law of attraction and are attempting to create deliberately, we are also trying to remove some of those negative patterns that have been established in our brains, you know, for decades. And meditation is one of the ways that helps us remove the old patterns as well as establish new, more beneficial ones to our experience.
So what you're saying here is that when I sit quietly and try to think about as little as possible and just put, let my brain go to a rest state, I'm actually doing wonderful things to my brain?
Yes, you are. Your brain loves you for it.
So more is less, or actually less is more in this case.
Right. Yeah, because you quiet the monkey brain. You quiet the brain that is excessively running the same old patterns over and over and over again, you know, just repeatedly the same, you know, they're having the same thoughts, the same responses, the same, you know, you're replaying old conversations or experience and responding to them in the same way over and over and over again. And that's what, you know, that the conscious mind does. Meditation is one of the ways to kind of quiet that conscious mind so that you can actually access the subconscious and, you know, access hopefully the good things that are there, and then also remove some of the things that you don't want from your experience.
Including chronic stress, right?
Yes, including stress, absolutely.
And including making sure that we put the various brain animals away in their cages, so we don't want the lizard running around and the monkey running around and whoever else is up there.
I know!
Reptiles and monkeys and what else is in there?
Lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, yeah, it's a scary place. But, you know, the thing is, that's why we have a frontal lobe. The frontal lobe is like the zoo master.
Oh,
my gosh, I got a zoo in my skull.
Oh, yeah, you do. And the sooner you realize it, the better.
Well, I do know this, that my frontal lobe grew by at least 2 millimeters during the last hour or 45 minutes or so. So, I mean, if nothing else, the zoo has expanded.
Right. Well, now you hopefully there are more connections. So the Zoo Master has now a communication channel established with the amygdala and the hippocampus and all the other areas that tend to want to run the show.
Well, I want to run the show, particularly since this is our show.
Right.
Let's get back to running the show. So meditation's good for us. Does this also mean that we can use meditation to break free of those negatives? I mean, I'm thinking earlier on in your recitation, you described the amygdala and the role that it plays in helping us feel and express emotions, and the dis-ease, if you will, that occurs when under certain circumstances it is incapable of giving an emotional response, particularly a positive emotional response. Can I then conclude in sort of a roundabout way here that meditation actually helps to kick the amygdala back into gear?
Yes, because that's exactly what they found. In fact, you know what? The researchers hypothesized that there would be a decreased blood flow to the amygdala, and they found the opposite. Because like you were saying, they thought that the amygdala was only involved in negative emotion, and so surely the meditators have found a way to quiet that. But what they found was that it was an increased blood flow, but there was also an increase in the connection between the frontal lobe and the amygdala. So now the amygdala was more, it was better equipped to evaluate emotions, all types, but the frontal lobe, the prefrontal cortex, could then use the information from the amygdala more effectively. And so in terms of, you know, that's one of the things what, you know, the meditators, especially the Buddhist monks, they meditate, some of them, the ones who do the mindfulness meditation, they meditate specifically on the terms of love and compassion. So they basically make themselves feel these good emotions and just kind of revel in it. So they're basically activating the part of their brain, kind of re-stimulating the amygdala to be more sensitive to positive things, to happy, feel-good emotions, as opposed to only to the negative ones. And then so the amygdala becomes more balanced, but then also the frontal cortex still says, yes, I thank you for this information. Now, you know, let me take over from here.
So when people are actively involved in meditating or praying or in some way focusing on reconnecting with God or connecting with spirit or a higher power or whatever, they're also reconnecting their brains together.
Yes, actually, yes. According to Dr. Nuremberg, he thinks that that's what they're doing.
we won't dispute whether or not people's religious beliefs are appropriate. That's beyond the measure of this particular show.
Of course. He's an atheist, so.
Well, that's all right. You know, I have some good friends who are atheists, and they often have some very good insights. This one obviously has some good insights as well, but just the fact that we're rewiring our brains while we're reconnecting to spirit or anything else, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yes, yes.
It connects up in ways that I didn't quite expect, but perhaps should have. Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to try to reconnect with the other side, spirit, God, whatever you want to call it, it means your brain's got to be operating properly. I mean, because there has to be the physical side of the connection as well as the mental or emotional, spiritual side of the connection.
Yeah, that's exactly what all of this brain imaging is showing. You know, they're showing that people who meditate long-term, they have a thicker cortex. And one of the things we know is that as people age, the cortex thins out. It gets thinner. Meditation helps you to maintain the thickness of your cortex. The other thing that they saw that meditators have is they have a thicker corpus callosum. That's the connection between the left and the right brain. It's also strengthened in those who meditate long term.
So we actually have found a situation here where someone who is thick-headed is better off.
Right. Yeah, when they say thicker, I think they mean the skull more than the cortex.
Well, something's filling up the space. I mean, it doesn't really matter, I suppose.
I guess.
No, but it does matter. Apparently it matters based on whether or not we're talking about neurons or simple skull tissue.
Yeah, because what that means is in terms of your behavior, as you lose cortical mass and your cortex gets thinner, then you're relegated to simply the lower regions of your brain taking over your life. And so, you know, what that looks like is people become more emotional, more irritable, more depressed, whatever, you know. And so those...
Bipolar
is a different issue. But, but people who age and experience dementia and Alzheimer's, that's what's happening with their brain as it thins out.
Well, then let me raise a question that has long been a point of consideration for me. The thought that if I can focus more and more on positive things and positive thoughts and feelings more often in my life, ideally continuously in my life, I will actually extend my life and produce a happier, longer life as a result. It sounds to me like that's essentially what you're describing.
Yes, yes, because all of this research is coming under the umbrella of the body-brain connection. You know, there was a time when scientists did not believe the brain and the body were connected in any significant way, but now that they know that it does, and so they're doing all this research to show that there is a connection and that we can basically use our minds to affect our health and to, you know, heal our bodies and cure diseases and those kinds of things. So that's definitely where this is heading.
Wow. Okay. Yes. Yeah. I can see why you were so excited about doing the show before we even started the show.
You were
telling me this before we got going, like, oh my goodness, this is so amazing. Well,
it is amazing.
It is amazing. And it's also reassuring.
It is, yes. I mean, I can barely sit on my chair right now. I was like, so I want to stand up and proclaim.
Well, you don't want to do that because you'll move away too far away from the microphone. But I appreciate the sentiment.
Okay.
Sentiment is good. All right. So let's see. How can we apply these thoughts? I mean, I guess one obvious thing is we continue to focus on positive things in our lives as much as we can. Mm-hmm. Positive emotions, you know, make that a priority all the time. That's got to be good for us. It's got to be healthy.
Yeah, because one thing it does, it kind of gets your amygdala back into a balance instead of being stuck in the mode of alert and alarm. So it gets you away from anxiety and depression and more to a balanced life emotionally, definitely.
Well, to lead off of what Walt was saying, can we think ourselves young?
Yes. That's my final answer.
Wow. I don't even care if you're right or not. I'm in favor of it.
I absolutely believe that because as we're showing here, the meditators are healing themselves. They're healing their brains. Their brains are resisting aging. So I'm sure, you know, that it can reverse aging. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you talked about stopping the process of thinning the cortical layer. And I'm not entirely sure what the cortical layer is, but I know it's important.
Well, so all these regions that I talked about, the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe, the thalamus, all of those are involved in the cortex. So the cortex is that area just beneath your scalp. And that's where all your neurons are. So, you know, that's that the part of the brain that does all this sensory image processing of the information that's coming in.
Well, then here's the question that it raises in my mind, or perhaps in my brain at this point.
Yes.
Is it possible not only to keep it from to keep the cortical area from decreasing, from thinning, is it possible to thicken it?
Yes, 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 absolutely.
So somebody who's already in a state of decline could actually climb out of their decline.
Absolutely. Yes, yes. And there are schools of thought where they're teaching people who are suffering from different neurological diseases to employ regular meditation as part of their treatment. So, yeah.
So we're talking about being able to treat Alzheimer's.
Yep, exactly.
We're talking about being able to treat all forms of dementia.
Yes, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, yeah, what, you know.
And to do it through feeling good.
Yes.
And meditating.
Yes.
What the hell took him so long? No, seriously, I mean, this is very cool stuff, and it's so simplified now that we've gotten past the scientific jargon and down to the bone marrow, if you will. It makes sense.
Yes.
It makes sense that all this should be going on and that there should be a direct physical connection to what we have inferred for years and years, which is that we can get actually physically make ourselves better by thinking well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and that's where the, you know, the branch of neuroscience, there's a department even in the NIH that's involved with the body-mind connection and how that relates to health. And they're doing a lot of research. You know, unfortunately, it's still, when it comes to the bureaucracy, it's still in the research stage. But there are practitioners out there who are already putting this type of information into practice. So.
Now, I have to admit, I would also imagine that there are people in the scientific community who resist this research and the conclusions
yes.
drawn by this research.
Yes,
so in fairness, we should probably touch on that for, about a minute.
Right, because, you know, Dr. Newberg, he does the research. He's not a practicing physician. But one of the people on his team I mentioned who is collaborated with him on this research is Dr. Amen.
Right.
And, yes, he is actually internationally renowned because he's a practicing psychiatrist who uses some of this, you know, these studies in his practice. So when the people, you know, he has a brain imaging diagnosis center, and every patient of his, he takes pictures of their brain. And to figure out exactly what's wrong, he uses those pictures to help him, and then he prescribes a particular, treatment, which sometimes includes meditation and other, all kinds of diets, exercise, drumming, I mean, you name it. He's into it all. And he's been, you know, recently I read an article where there's a branch, there's some doctors who want to take away his license.
Yeah, heaven forbid he should actually produce positive results from research.
And the thing is, the beautiful thing is, he's becoming extremely rich and popular because so many patients are tired with the old way of treating psychiatry and mental illness that they're clamoring for him. This guy has, you know, his practices, he has several offices, but they have waiting lists that are months long. And so, you know, which is part of the reason why he's...
They're jealous.
Exactly.
Well, also, we're talking about going after people's livelihoods here. I mean, Professor Sean Aker at Harvard pointed out that when a therapist finds that you have some kind of emotional problem, some sort of abnormal condition, a disease, if you will, they love it because that means they're one step away from finding 10 others for you.
Yes.
And if they can find 10 for you, then you're a patient for life. Well, this is a direct threat to that
exactly.
Whole modality.
Yeah, definitely.
On the other hand, it's also an opportunity because those who can, those on the negative side, if you will, the dark side, those researchers on the dark side who refuse to buy into all this woo-woo positive psychology crap, who actually decide to, you know, change their way of doing things, they can actually share in the beneficence. They can share in the bounty.
Yes, they can. But it would involve stepping out of the comfort of the accepted or the popular or the majority.
Comfort zone. I think you were on the right track there. I think that's it. It's their comfort zone. They don't want to step out of the comfort zone. And guess what, guys? You just might have to.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's only a matter of time, I think.
In fact, it's only a matter of time until they start establishing a new scientific branch called woo-woo.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know, this field of psychiatry definitely, you know, needs some reformation.
Psychiatry.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, most of the sciences, I think that probably applies to.
Yeah, but it's particularly sciences because before all these brain imaging and other techniques, they were just. Yeah, the practice was not, it was limited. They couldn't take x-rays and do other types of, like you can do the rest of the body. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of guessing.
Philosophically frozen, I think.
Right. So they could only go based on what the patient said.
Yeah. And only go on based on what the patient said and based on what their theory said.
Right, exactly. Based on past experience, whatever data they had collected, that was it. But now they have pictures, real pictures.
This is actually what I would call healthy science.
Yes.
Because healthy science is constantly evolving and constantly rejecting old ideas that were thought to be hard and fast truths and actually turned out to be not so hard and fast truths.
Exactly, yes.
But what's cool about it is they're not doing it based on democracy. They're doing it based on proving and disproving.
Yeah, and the pictures don't lie.
Which is very cool.
Yes.
And much needed and gives me some faith in science again. I say that because earlier today I posted something on Facebook. I should share it with you guys. But
I saw it. I read it.
Oh, did you see it? Okay, yeah. There was a researcher who deliberately put out a false study in order to deceive people into thinking that eating chocolate was going to help them lose weight. And yep. He actually got his article published in major publications around the world, including yep. Cosmopolitan in two of their foreign language divisions, Shape Magazine, which of course is on most grocery store newsstands. They published it. And the only reason that Men's Health didn't publish it is that they put off publication until September. So they sort of avoid embarrassment on this one.
Right.
But after reading that and hearing this, this renews my faith. This makes me think that science, well, faith and science, that's something you're not supposed to combine together, but I combine them together. It renews my faith in science, my faith in the scientific process that actually believes in proving things, disproving things, and not being upset when something that was proven is disproven.
Yeah, and, you know, interestingly, I read that article that you're speaking about, and, you know, after reading it, I realized, two things. One, it's one of the reasons why I now have to spend so much time with biostatistics, because that's a big problem in research. A lot of scientists are not statisticians.
Mm.
But the other thing that it reminded me of was the study that got the whole country in trouble that started this low-fat craze. It's a similar thing that happened. The scientists actually excluded data that would have disproved his hypothesis. Now we have access to the data some 30, 40 years down the road after the damage has already been done, and the whole country is still believing that a low-fat diet is good for you. You know, it's
when in fact it's not.
It's not. And so, you know, it was started by a scientist, you know, who worked for the government, and he had, you know, collected data from a variety of countries, some 52 countries. And in the study that he published, there were only like 11 that showed that, okay, this country, they ate a high fat and they had a higher incidence of heart disease. But there were other factors that were involved. But there were other countries that showed the exact opposite, and those were left out of the study.
This is one of the reasons I like Dr. Sean Aker. I mentioned him earlier, the Harvard professor who has the most popular class at Harvard. His positive psychology class is the most popular class. And one of the things that he mentions in his TED Talk is the idea. Well, first of all, he says, I've been told that you're not supposed to start off a talk with a picture of a graph.
Right.
I'm going to show you a picture of a graph. And he proceeds to show the picture of a graph, and he says there are two very important things about this graph. Now, you look at the graph, and it's a very typical hyperbola, very clean hyperbola, with one dot outside of the hyperbola. And he says there are two things you should know about this. First of all the data in this graph are false. And second of all, you should notice that there is one piece of data in this graph that is screwing up my data. Yes. Fortunately, using statistical methods, I can remove that data and therefore make my graph a nice, perfect graph, and thereby enable myself to be published and to become a successful author.
Yep.
And in that little very funny soliloquy that he does, he really points to the dramatic weakness in the way research has been practiced by so many people over the years. So to first of all hear that whoever that doctor was who sent us on the low-fat craze got his comeuppance, it's like, well, thank goodness, what the heck took so long?
Well, even though there are scientists who've shown that what he said was, what he did was wrong, but it's not as widespread as the erroneous data that he published. So the overriding idea is still that a low-fat diet is healthy.
Which means it's going to take quite some time for that to for society to overcome that, which is a sad point.
Yeah.
But the second thing, and this is the part that I really love about what Dr. Aker says, he says that outlier, that outlying point there, is where he likes to focus his attention. It's what he wants to study. Because he says it's the exceptions to the rule that tell us so much more than what the rule tells us.
Right.
That's where all the great inventions, all the great discoveries, all the great advances are made, by studying the exceptions. That's the exciting part. I mean, basically, the research you're describing here with Dr. What's his name?
Newberg.
That Dr. Newberg was studying fell into the area of what used to be known as the exceptions.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the exceptions are now becoming the basis for the new rule. That's very cool.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, when you're the lead neuroscientist at the University of Pennsylvania, you know, this rule has arrived.
So I think we can probably expect that the University of Pennsylvania is going to be offering the first doctorate of woo-woo. That's crazy. No, seriously. This has been very, very educational. We've got about a minute left. What summary can you give us? What conclusions can you draw that give us food for thought and prepare us for what's going to be coming next week?
So next week, I'm not sure yet. I'm looking at different things. There's so many great research out there that, you know, the public is not aware of, and as a neuroscientist, you're eager to kind of share this with the world.
Well, the fact that you're not sure is actually a good thing, because you were not sure last week, and look what you brought us this week.
Yeah, because, you know, I've read all these things before, and then I get to reread them again. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, this is a good one. Okay.
All right. Well, then, I guess we'll just have to keep it a secret until next week. That's actually a way to get people to come back. So that's actually a good thing. You know, in radio, you want people to keep coming back. So, you know, you have to come back next week to find out what the next great discovery is.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Yoana, thank you so much for doing all this research and sharing all the information with us. I'm very grateful to learn that meditating is actually good for me.
Yes, absolutely. My pleasure, as always.
And Mark, even though you didn't feel like you had enough that you could actually talk about except to be enthusiastic, you did that very well, so thank you. And we'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody. It might seem crazy what I'm about to say. Sunshine, she's here, you can take a break. I'm a hot air balloon that could go to space. Like I don't care, baby, by the way, because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof, because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth, because I'm happy. Clap along if you know what happiness is to you, because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like that's what you want to do. Waste your time.